Let's get started now. I want to thank Jeff Doolittle for the last couple of weeks. I thought he did a great job, and he's such a good teacher. And yes. Some of you are saying, oh, we got Rick tonight. So here we go. Sorry about that. Let me pray, and we'll get going. Father, thank you so much for who you are. Thank you that you have revealed yourself to us. Thank you that we have the freedom and opportunity to come here tonight and to study and think together. God, I pray that you would use this tonight in a powerful way in each one of our lives. In Jesus' name, amen. So we are talking about transformation. We've talked about the four big questions up till now have been, where did we come from? Why are we here? So you have to know where you came from, and then once you answer that question, the natural next question is, well, then why? Why am I here? What is there a purpose for me being here? And that sort of thing. The third one was, what is evil and where did it come from? Why do bad things happen? Why do we do things that are bad as human beings and that sort of thing? Even though they hurt us and hurt other people, why do we do those things? And then we come to this particular the question that Jeff dealt with was liberation, or what can be done about evil? What can be done about it? And he talked about that the last couple of weeks, looking at it from the worldview point of view, alternate worldview, and then from a biblical point of view. Now then, we want to talk about this question for the next 2 weeks. How do we change? And really, in many ways, we ought to say, can we change? And if so, how? Because there would be many people who, as we're going to see tonight, who would say, well, we can't change. And we'll see some of that as we go through this. But can we change? If so, how do we change? Excuse me. Evil has left an imprint upon us. It has marred us. It has shaped us in some ways. Whatever you think about it, we are not people who are perfect. If you don't believe that about yourself, just ask somebody else who knows you, and they will inform you that you are not perfect. We are not perfect people in any way whatsoever. So how can we change? How can we grow? How can we develop and become more of the person that we feel like we ought to be or that we long to be but haven't become? How do we do that change? And we want to look tonight at these five different alternate worldviews, how they respond to that question. And then next week, we'll look at what the Bible has to say. When I was, some of you have heard this story before, or some of you have even read a book that I wrote that gives this story in it, but I was moved into a town, and I wanted to have an impact on the university was there, but not on the students, but on the faculty. So I went to a man that I met who was on the faculty, got to know him a little bit, spent some time with him, and after about 6 months of spending weekly time with him in his office, I just asked him, how could I have an influence on the faculty here at the university? And he says, well, you need to show them that you're willing to learn as well as have something to say. I said, okay. He said, take some classes. Show them that you're willing to engage with what they have to say and that sort of thing. So I signed up for a counseling theories class. My friend was in the counseling department. I found myself counseling all the time, even though that wasn't my training. I had one class in counseling during seminary. So I said, okay, I'll take a counseling course. So it was a master's level counseling theories course. We studied all of the major theories of counseling from the time of Sigmund Freud up to the present day. And we looked at all those different theories and everything. And I remember the professor over and over and over again. Nice man. But he kept saying the goal of counseling is to help people to change. To help people to change. To help people to change. And then he would talk about everything's relative. Everything's relative. And I heard that week after week for several weeks, and I finally raised my hand, and I said, change to what? And I looked at the professor, and there was this blank stare, as he looked at me, and then he started turning white, and I realized in that moment I had embarrassed the professor. Because, I mean, he was a man that's older than I am right now and had been teaching in the university for years and years and years. And I guess no one had ever asked the obvious question before. Change to what? And he had no answer. Change to what? If everything's relative, I said to him, it seems to me, if the goal is to change and everything's relative, what makes me think that that person ought to change to be more like me? Maybe I need to change to be more like them. Maybe psychotic is what's okay. I mean, if it's all relative, I mean, I don't get it. And it was a very awkward situation because I never wanted to embarrass him. And I didn't think it was that profound of a question and everything. But that becomes a major issue. As I have studied this particular issue, I have found that this, I get more blank stares from people all over the country on this question of how do we change. I don't care if they're professors in a university or Christians in a church and have been there for 30 years. How do you change? And I get blank stares. I've gone and taught at pastors' conferences before, and I ask them, how do we change? And I'll get a variety of little answers here and there, but when I start pressing them more and more and more, I get the blank stares. I don't know. I don't know how people change. So we're going to be looking at these alternate worldviews, but I want to tell you right up front, and I'll reiterate it at the end, most Christians that exist in America today anyway, and that's the only place I've spent a lot of time is in America, most Christians in America today would buy into one of these worldviews more than the biblical worldview we're going to look at next week. Most Christians would say one of these would be, if they were really honest, is what they believe is true and how they live life. And so I want us to look at this for a few minutes. The very first page of your notes there. By the way, how did you enjoy the reading of B.F. Skinner this week? Yeah. At least it was short, right? It was only 4 pages instead of 21 or whatever. 4 pages out of his book, Beyond Worth and Dignity, Dignity and Worth. There on that first page, we focus on B.F. Skinner. Some have called him the most influential psychologist in the world after Sigmund Freud. After Sigmund Freud, in fact, he was a young contemporary of Sigmund Freud, came on the scene at the end of Sigmund Freud's life, basically lived for the whole 1900s, from 1904 to 1990. That's when he lived, was in that span of time. There in that first paragraph, I talk about who he was contemporaries with. He was very influenced by Francis Bacon's previous studies on inductive study, or what we might call the scientific method of investigation and study. He was very interested in that. He grew up in Pennsylvania, a small town in Pennsylvania. His father was a lawyer. His mom was a stay-at-home mom, very devoted to her children and to her husband and everything. And little B.F. Skinner was, when he was a boy, was known for always creating things, or as his mom would say, creating messes, because the things he would create would often create a mess. And but he was always very creative, always looking for ways to make things work better or faster or easier and that sort of thing. And so he was always experimenting with little things. He went to a little college called Hamilton College, and he studied to be a writer. He got out of school, out of college, and went into writing. The problem is, he never wrote anything. It's hard to make a living as a writer when you never write anything. So that wasn't working. So he went to work at a bookstore. He thought, well, at least I'll be close to books, to other writers, and that sort of thing. And he picks up a book that sort of sparked his interest by Pavlov. And some of you are familiar with him a little bit. But he began to read how Pavlov was experimenting with animals in terms of getting them to change their behavior with positive and negative reinforcement. And I remember in junior high school having to do some experiments. Today they would not be allowed, but I went down to the pet store and I bought a little rat, and I built this long cage kind of a thing of metal flooring with glass sides and a top, and I had this, the bottom of it was connected to electricity, current, a battery, and this poor little rat, I had to do this experiment. This is part of what I was learning in school, but I had to do this experiment to see if the rat would go to this end to get the food more quickly, or if he would run away from this side more quickly because of the negative reinforcement of the electricity in the floor and everything. Which would make him move fastest and do things quickest? Positive or negative reinforcement? That all goes back to Pavlov. And Skinner was fascinated with that. And remember what Skinner is like. He's always trying to figure out how to make things work or how to make them work better. And he's wrestling with, at the same time, this particular question. You can tell as you read the later writings of B.F. Skinner, this whole idea of how do we change was a big issue for him. And he was wrestling with that. So how can we get people to change? And basically he decided the way that you get people to change is to change their environment. You can't really change people's essence or their core or who they really are on the inside. All you can change is their behavior. Have any of you heard of something called behavior modification in education? Yeah. If you've gone to school in America and you're my age or younger, you were exposed to behavior modification principles. That education, a lot of education was built around that. In fact, B.F. Skinner talks about going into schoolrooms, going into one of his children's schoolrooms, and the teacher was practicing what he would call the delayed gratification. Give a test, you take the test, and turn all the tests in, and a week or two later, you get the test back with a grade on it. And he says, that's delayed. That's not going to change their behavior the best. What you need to do is give them immediate feedback on how they're doing on the test. I go down to, when I moved to California, to take the driver's test and everything. And I would answer a question, and it would tell me right there if I was right or wrong. Wonder where they got that idea. Goes all the way back to B.F. Skinner. He's influenced so many areas of medicine, of education, of psychology. I ended up teaching in that same graduate counseling program that I started taking courses in. They asked me to teach there, and so I was teaching, and I would have clinical psychology students who would who were working on their master's in clinical psych come in my classes in counseling. We were in a similar department, and I got to talking to some of them, and I found out they were taking my course as an elective. And I said, well, how many other counseling courses do you take? Well, none. I said, really? No courses in counseling? You're studying to be a clinical psychologist and you don't have to take any counseling courses at all? No. I said, tell me about your courses. So they bring me their syllabus and some of their course requirements and that sort of thing. And all of it has to do with medication, those kind of things, how to understand a PDR, a physician's desk reference on medications, how to read that, how to study that, how to prescribe medications that will alter behavior. Wonder where that came from. You can't change a person, B.F. Skinner said. You can only change their behavior. So what we need to do is learn how to medicate people so that their behavior will change. How much of that is impacting our world today? mean, we live in a world that is highly impacted by B.F. Skinner and is still being affected by him today. Now, that was in that school that I was teaching. I'm sure in other schools there's varieties of what's important and that sort of thing, but this is something. I mean, there have been on record communities who have tried what some of B.F. Skinner's sort of out there ideas of putting medication in the drinking water, sort of make everybody more calm. Just put some mild sedatives in the drinking water, calm everyone down, and take the rage out of people in our community so that we can advertise we have a less crime rate than somebody else. I mean, it's wacky, but it's B.F. Skinner has had that kind of an influence in our world today. He ended up teaching at University of Minnesota and then teaching at University of Indiana for a number of years, about 10, 11, 12 years. And then he, in 1947, went back to Harvard to give a series of lectures where he had gotten his MD degree in psychology, which is a whole other story. That was you can read about it in here, but it's interesting how he got his MD degree there. But he gets invited back, he speaks there, and then they ask him to come on the faculty, and he spent the rest of his life. That was 1947. He died in 1990, and most of that time he taught at Harvard. In the area of psychology and also in the area of education. He taught in both of those different areas. He's had quite an impact on the world of medicine, on the world of education, on the world of counseling or psychology. He's had quite an impact and still continues to do that today. And we'll see some more about him in a little bit. Okay. With that in mind, let's look at our notes now. Let's look at these five alternate worldviews. And we're going to see B.F. Skinner start to pop up again in the last two when we get there. When we talk about transformation, we're talking about changing from something to something. And the deeper question is, can we change inside, or can we only change on the outside in terms of what we do, or can we even change at all? All of those are aspects of this question that we're going to look at. So when we look at this personal theistic substitute for God, what are some of the views, the isms that go along with this view? Okay, what are some of the isms? You're getting it, I can tell, okay? Deism would be one of those, right? Deism. Finite godism would be one of them as well. A form of open theism would be a part of this one as well. Deism basically, remember, if you'll recall, has to do with God created this world like a clock. He put all the pieces together, wound it up, set it on the mantle, said, okay, you've got everything you need. Now make it work. I've given you everything you need. I've even wound it up so it'll function. Now you make it work. So we talk about, where do we come from? A deist would say we came from God. He created. But after that, he has been out of the picture altogether. So there is no supernatural intervention whatsoever in this world, according to a deist. There is no scripture that's authoritative, because that would be supernatural. There is no Satan and satanic activity in the world, because that would be supernatural in some form or fashion. There is no outside supernatural force out there or in here that is working to make anything different. He's given us everything we need to make life work. We need to figure out the systems. We need to figure that out. So a personal... A deist would say, number one, there is a personal creator God who created the universe, including mankind. Is it the God of the Bible? And they would say, well, I don't believe the Bible's true, but that God that it talks about there, yeah, I believe that's the kind of God that it was. Number two, this creator God has revealed himself, both himself and the systems he set in motion to make life work in his creation. Now, we're going to see that down below. We're going to read through these sections down below by Thomas Paine and Thomas Jefferson. But he's revealed himself in his creation. And you'll hear them talk about creation a lot. He's revealed himself in creation, and he's made it self-evident what those systems are that are there. Number three, mankind must continue to discover through natural observation and common sense both God and his created system. So we need to work to discover what they are. And then look at number four. Mankind changes for the better through, and I mentioned three things here that you see repeatedly in their literature. Personal education, guided by reason in the systems around him. So the whole thing of education became very important. We've got to educate people to be thoughtful, to be reasonable, and that sort of thing, to be good analysts of creation so that we can see what those systems are and get in tune with those systems and make sure that they're functioning properly and everything. Now, that created a debate, by the way. There are a lot of different forms of education that we could talk about, but when we talk about education, there are, and you talk about going to college. What kind of college do I want to go to? There are colleges and there are programs that are geared in two primary ways. You'll have a lot of major universities are called research institutions, and they are there to research, basically, if I could summarize this from a deist point of view, to research how things work, systems, and to create people who can go get a job with those things and get involved in making the systems of this world work better. There's another flow of thought in higher education that talks about general education. Get a good general education. You need to study the math and the science and the literature and the history and the language. You need to get a broad education so that you can have a better sense about you. You can understand more things about what's going on in the world around you and make more sense of it. I've sat with families before that a husband and wife will debate about their son or daughter who's going to go to college. Do we want to send them to go get an education so they can get a job, or do we want to help them be a well-rounded person and get a good general education? And there's a lot of debate about that in all circles of life in America. But a lot of that started here. Before deism, general education was something that was considered the premier by almost all people who pursued some kind of higher education. Get a good general education first, and then you can get a more specific, you can major on something and get a more specific training for a job. But with the implementation, with the rise of deism in America, particularly in the 1700s, there became this rise of understanding the systems and getting people who are trained to work the systems, to make them work, whether it's in government, whether it's in mechanics of some sort, whatever it may be, you do that. Second bullet point there, not only personal education, but working hard to imitate God as he has revealed himself through his creation. And again, that last portion is really important. Imitate God. Well, what is God like? Well, look at his creation. And we're going to see some of that as we read below in just a second, how they would say that works. And then third bullet point, particularly through a government that limits our vices without taking away our natural rights. So how can we change education? Debate on what kind of education, but education is important. Working hard to mimic God in his creation. And thirdly there, government is also there to help us change, to eliminate the vices and not get in the way of our freedoms. Recognizing that we have vices as human beings. We do things that are wrong. We make mistakes. We hurt other people. So we need to have government to keep that under control without that government getting too much in control of everything else. So look at the two sections down below in italics there. The first one is by Thomas Paine in his famous book, The Age of Reason, which he wrote from England to America. When America was America was considered by philosophers like Thomas Paine the grand experiment. No nation had ever rebelled against a monarchy and won before. Okay? None had ever done that. And they're setting out on this bold course of independence to set up their own government. And so they saw it as this grand experiment to put their kind of system thinking in place in the world. And so he wrote books, and The Age of Reason was one of the premier books that he wrote with Americans in mind. He says this, "The moral duty of man consists in imitating the moral goodness and beneficence of God." Well, how do you know what that is? Look at the next statement. "Manifested in the creation toward all his creatures." That seen as we daily do the goodness of God to all men, it is an example calling upon all men to practice the same toward each other. He created this world with these systems that can bring us life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, they would say. God made that possible for us to do that. We need to do that for other people. We need to make life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness something that's available to other people as well, like God has made available for us. Notice the second paragraph. Societies produced by our wants. This is a very crucial sentence here. Society is produced by our wants and government by our wickedness. The former promotes our happiness positively by uniting our affections. The latter, speaking of government, negatively by restraining our vices. The one encourages intercourse, interaction. The other creates distinctions. The first is a patron. The last is a punisher. So again, he talks about government has its place in bringing about change. So how do we change? How do we change? Get a good education, they would say. Secondly, they would say, work hard to figure out what God is like in his creation and imitate him. Because they would say he is a good God. He's just uninvolved. He's a good God. We need to imitate his goodness as we see it explained and particularized in creation. And thirdly, government. Government which restrains our vices, which limits how much bad, how much evil we can do, and sort of keeps that under control. That will make it possible for us to change, to work the systems, and for life to get better and better, and therefore we are changing in the process of doing that. Make sense? That's what they would say for us. This particular view appeals to those who want to take responsibility and those who want to be in control. It appeals to Americans, in other words. All of us want to take responsibility, so to speak, but we especially want to be in control. And this is I guarantee you, if I could sit down and get the gut-level honest reaction of a lot of Christians in America today, how do you change? Well, you got to be smarter, got to get education. You've got to work hard. That you've got to do that to figure out and be a good person. That's what you've got to do. And everything. They would say all these same things. They say a lot of these same things. That's what you got to do to change and everything. Okay. That's what a deist or a finite godist would say in terms of change. Let's look at the next alternate worldview, an impersonal theistic substitute for God. All five of these are substitutes for God. The first two of these are theistic. In other words, you'd ask a person, do you believe in God? And they would say yes. Is there a God? Absolutely. They would respond that way. However, the difference between the first view and this view is the first view would say, and he, speaking of that God, and the second view would say, and it. speaking of God. Now, they might say he sometimes, but when you follow their literature, they're talking about the universe, which is God. Pantheism is the primary expression of this today. Sometimes panentheism, which means God is in everything that's in the universe, and but God is the soul of the universe that brings this universe together and all that. But pantheism is basically saying this universe is ultimate. It's God. Benedict Spinoza, we've studied him from the very beginning. He is the great Western proponent of this, and he has done a lot of teaching in this area. And as we will see when we get to the fourth view, the it sometimes blends over and becomes nature, which is what the fourth view would predominantly say today as well. So they would refer to this universe as nature sometimes. We'll get there in a few minutes. Let's look at 1, 2, 3, and 4. God, or nature, as Benedict Spinoza would talk about it, is the essence of the power and material of the universe, which has eternally existed, or God is made up of the visible universe, his body, and the invisible universe, his soul, and is in the process of becoming all that it will become. So this universe is growing and developing. So do you believe in God? Yes. If they're really honest, then they would say, and it, this universe, is learning and growing and developing. It's getting better and better. God is getting better and better. And we have a responsibility to get better and better, because as we get better and better, God gets better and better. And that's the way we worship God, ultimately, in this sense. Number two, either each person is God as part of the universe or has God in them as part of the soul of the universe. And number three, absolute evil does not really exist, but we call good that which helps us be more like our nature, like our natural self, and evil we'll call that which takes us further from our nature, according to Spinoza. We are who we are, good or evil, whatever, we are who we are. And he would basically say, "What? There really is no such thing of what Christians call or Jews would call," which he was exposed to both in heavy doses in his childhood. He would say, good and evil, the way they talk about it, don't really exist. But for the sake of discussion, we'll call evil that which takes us away from just being ourselves, who we really are. And we'll call good that which is getting back to just who we really are, our nature, our natural selves. He would say what we ought to do is just do what comes natural. Number four, each person experiences positive change as they become more aware through understanding and reason of their own nature and become more true to that nature. Our nature itself does not really change, only our understanding and acceptance of our true nature changes. Let me make a couple of comments here. First of all, when I talk about through understanding and reason in parentheses there, it's in parentheses because that would be Spinoza. That's a Western mentality of pantheism. There would be many Eastern views of pantheism that would say, no, reason and understanding has nothing to do with it. In fact, they would say, I've told you before, you need to take your brain, put it in a little box, lock it up, and throw it away. We think too much. So that would be Eastern pantheism. But Western pantheism, and we live in the West, so we're just talking about that here, would say reason and understanding are important to understand nature, this universe, and live consistently with who we are. The only thing that really needs to change, according to this, is the way we think about it. Now, Spinoza began to have an impact in the world of counseling and psychology and education in America as well. Even though he lived in the 1600s, he started having a resurgence in the 1900s and into the 21st century. He started having a resurgence of influence. And this whole idea of just do what comes natural goes all the way back to Spinoza. and his influence. This whole idea of we just need to change the way we think. When I studied those 10 counseling, major counseling theories, some of the primary psychologists were saying in their views of how we ought to counsel people, they were saying, you know, people really don't need to change. They just need to get this idea of good and evil out of their mind. We are just beings. We're animals. We're just advanced animals, and we just need to do what comes natural. And all that goes back to this. And it's the same kind of idea. We don't need to change what we do. We don't need to change who we are. We just need to change the way we think about ourselves. Because we got this all screwed up. We're thinking we're bad people. We're really not. We just need to do what comes natural. That's what we need to do. Now, lest you think that's just me making all that up, look down below. Quoting from Benedict Spinoza, he says there at the very beginning, let's just look at the first couple of paragraphs right now. Thus it is apparent to everyone that I wish to direct all sciences to one end and aim so that we may attain to the supreme human perfection. Now, don't get thrown by that, because he's going to come back and explain what that is. It's all pointing to attain to the supreme human perfection, which we have named, and therefore whatever in the sciences does not serve to promote our object will have to be rejected as useless. To sum up the matter in a word, all our actions and thoughts must be directed to this one end. Now notice what he goes on and says. Thus in life it is before all things useful to perfect the understanding or reason as far as we can, and in this alone man's highest happiness or blessedness consists. So what is that perfect human perfection? It's the highest happiness or blessedness, for one thing. Wherefore, of a man who is led by reason, the ultimate aim or highest desire, whereby he seeks to govern all his fellows, is that whereby he is brought to the adequate conception of himself and of all things within the scope of his intelligence. You need to get to know yourself. Have you ever heard that? Know yourself. Get to know who you really are, and that's what you need to be. Do you have certain inclinations? Do you have certain desires? Are there certain things that make you happy? Go for it. Just accept that that's who you are. Go for it. That's what you need to do. And in doing so, you will achieve your personal human perfection in doing that, if you will pursue that. Look at the very last paragraph, the things that I've underlined there. Whatsoever in nature we deem to be evil or to be capable of injuring our faculty for existing and enjoying the rational life, we may endeavor to remove in whatever means safest to us. Just get rid of those ideas of anything being evil if they in any way get in the way of your happiness. Okay? And look at the last part that's underlined. Everyone without exception may, by sovereign right of nature, do whatever he thinks will advance his own interest. Okay? Everyone without exception may, by sovereign right of God, according to Spinoza, nature is God. By sovereign right of God, you have the right sovereignly by God to determine for yourself these kind of things. Do whatever you think will advance your interest, your own personal interest. That's what you have the right and the responsibility that God, the universe, has given you. That's what you need to do. Go be happy. Do what comes natural. Can we change? Spinoza would say, you know what? We don't need to change. That's the problem. We think we need to change, and we don't. All we need to really change is the way we think. Need to get our thinking straight and just do what comes natural. And you not only have the right to do that, God himself has given you the responsibility to do that and to pursue whatever you want to do that will make you happy. That's what you ought to do. Okay? Interesting. This particular view in America today is very popular. Why? Because it, first of all, tells me I don't have to do anything to change. And even though I'm still a mess, I don't have to feel guilty about it. Okay? So even though I still do things that hurt other people and hurt myself and I make a mess of things, I don't have to feel guilty about it because that's just who I am. Can you hear any excuses coming out of this? Well, that's just who I am. I can't change. That's just the way I'm made. That's just the way I'm designed by God, the universe, and everything. And we can fall into that trap. It's a form of denial that there is such a thing as evil and the ramifications of evil. And there's a denial that I need to change. And it's also wishful thinking that I don't feel guilty about anything that I do. Okay, let's look at the third view. The third view. A compromised dualistic substitute for God. Who is the person most famous for promoting this? Plato, all right. Plato is the one. Now, I call this a compromised dualistic substitute for God. It's dualistic in the sense Plato talked about a dualism of the material evil world, which is eternal, always existed, always would, and the good thinking, reasoning, logic part of the world, which has always existed, it is eternal. So these eternal, two eternal realities, bad, evil, and which is expressed or seen in the material world, and good, the eternal good, which is expressed in thinking, reason, logic, that sort of thing. The reality is, though, and if you've read Nancy Piercy's book or if you've been reading that, you realize she keeps talking about the fact that we've taken those two realities that Plato said coexisted as eternal realities, as eternal ultimates, and everything, and we do the same thing today with other things other than good and evil. So we have our church life and we have our work life or our private life, and those two don't necessarily need to be consistent with one another, and all kinds of things. We can go out and do all kinds of wild things on Friday and Saturday night and show up on Sunday morning and go to church. And those are two different worlds, and we sort of live in those two realities at times, and everything. And Plato talked about that. So, number one there says there are two equally coexisting eternal realities. He said the eternal material world, which is evil, and the eternal immaterial wisdom, which is mind, reason, thought, logic, which is good. Those two eternal realities coexist, always have, always will. You can't get rid of evil. Okay? You can't get rid of good. They're always going to be coexistent in the universe forever and ever. Always have been, always will be. Number two, therefore, since everything that is material, including the body and brain of a person, is eternally evil, it will do evil eternally. You can't talk about change in terms of getting rid of evil in this view at all. You can't get rid of evil. It's always been here. It always will be. That's a reality. However, number three, the mental abilities, reason, and logic of a person are eternally good and can be grown and increased in their influence over the evil material world. Plato would talk about feed the dog. You got two dogs in the backyard. Feed the one you want to grow. Feed the mind, the brain, the thoughts, the logic, the wisdom of people, and it will grow and starve the evil part of mankind through a variety of different ways that he would say, use your reason and logic to figure out how and keep it in its place. Keep it restrained. Don't let it grow too big and strong and everything. You can't get rid of evil, but you can use your thinking, reason, logic of mankind to limit it. And number four, we are constantly changing. This is interesting, Plato. We're going to read some of this below. We are constantly changing, physically by deterioration of the body and mentally by either education or forgetfulness, which is interesting. Because early in Plato's writings, you don't see anything about forgetfulness. But he lived to be almost 80 years old, and he began to realize we forget things, and he was forgetting things, and began to realize that. So he says our minds are always changing. We're either growing them through education, or we're becoming more forgetful along the way. And by the way, that's one of the things that prompted him, as later as you go in his writings, for him to begin talking about the importance of the accumulation of knowledge, or the storehousing of knowledge. We need to write down what we learn and pass it on to the next generation, because there's going to come a point in time when we will forget and we won't pass it on. And if we'll pass it on, then they can build on it, and then the next generation can build on that, the next generation can build on that. That's where he got into a lot of that discussion for us. So we are constantly changing physically by deterioration of the body and mentally by either education or forgetfulness. In this sense, we are either working hard to exercise our mental muscles so they can positively influence the material world, or we are not, thus we are losing ground. One or the other. Plato wrote his dialogues, the dialogues of Plato. I've got a volume this thick that have probably 90% of his dialogues in them. And most all of them are conversations until his latest writings, but almost most of his writings in his life were these dialogues between his mentor, Socrates, and would-be students, people he came and asked him questions. And they would come and ask him questions, and you would think, here's the great Socrates, and he would give them all the answers. No, that's not how the dialogues work. The dialogues were dialogues between Socrates and these students. And guess who asked more questions than the students did? Socrates did. He would ask them, he would probe, what do you think about this? Well, if that's true, then wouldn't this be true and this be true, and wouldn't that lead to this? Oh, I don't like, and they would say, I don't like that. He said, oh, okay. Well, what about this? And he would ask more questions. And he would cause them to think. And often, Plato would end these dialogues with Socrates asking a question and the students or the people coming to him wrestling with them, and then it just stops. And there's no answer from Socrates. And it can be frustrating if you're looking for the answers when you read Plato. But what he's doing is exercising the very thing he's encouraging people to do. He's trying to make people think. He's trying to make you walk away from his writings and say, well, I wonder about this. Or could this be true? Or you could answer that question maybe three ways, and each one of them, and you start, you're just thinking and thinking and thinking. And that's what he was trying to promote in his writings. Number five, we cannot appreciatively change our material selves, our bodies, but we can keep working hard to increase our mental selves through the education and training of the mind, logic training, that sort of thing. And he goes on later on, as I mentioned, and talks about the gathering of information and collecting it. Plato would be excited about large libraries that had a collection of all these thoughts from people, collect in one place where you could go and read over and over and over again all different kinds of thoughts and ideas about things. Now, let's look at some of Plato down below. A little bit harder reading. We're going back to 400 BC or so. He says, now, although we speak of an individual as being the same so long as he continues to exist in the same form, and therefore assume that a man is the same person in his dotage in his older age as in his infancy, yet, for all we call him the same, every bit of him is different. So how do we change? We're going to naturally change. All of us are changing. We're all becoming different all the time. And every day you can see from his hair, his flesh, his bones, his blood, and all the rest of the body. And not only his body, for the same thing happens to his soul. And neither his manners, nor his disposition, nor his thought, nor his desires, nor his pleasure, nor his sufferings, nor his fears are the same throughout his life, for some of them grow while others disappear. So he would say, we're constantly changing. Our physical bodies are changing, which are evil, are constantly changing. Our minds are constantly changing. The question is not, are they changing or how to get them to change, but how to get them to change in the right direction. How to make the evil of our body to be less and less influential, and how to get the good thoughts and thinking and reasoning of our mind to grow and develop. How to do that. Look at the next paragraph. And the application of this principle to human knowledge is even more remarkable. For not only do some of the things we know increase while some of them are lost, so that even in our knowledge, we are not always the same. Even our brains, the way things we're thinking about things, are changing. But the principle applies as well to every single branch of knowledge. When we say we are studying, we really mean that our knowledge is ebbing away. We forget because our knowledge disappears, and we have to study so as to replace what we are losing, so the state of our knowledge may seem, at any rate, to be the same as it was before. He says it's a battle just to keep the same amount of knowledge we had 5 years ago. It's a constant battle. By the way, I've mentioned this before, there is truth to some degree in every one of these people. The New Testament will talk about how our minds are constantly being polluted by thoughts in the world around us, and we've got to constantly be replacing those thoughts with the Scriptures, washing out our brain, basically, our thoughts, the way we think about things with the Word, with the Bible, because they're constantly being polluted. A lot of similarities there in that sense. But if you ask Plato or a dualistic person who follows Plato's way of thinking and everything, they would say, what do you mean, how do we change? We change because we're changing. We're getting older. And every day, your body's a little bit different and your thinking's a little bit different. And you've got to, what it is, you've got to manage change. That's what you've got to do. And make sure that your evil body is being put in its place. The things that it wants to do, its evil desires. And you've got to accentuate, you've got to keep filling your mind with thoughts and reason and logic and keep studying, keep reading, doing those kind of things to keep your mind sharp, because it's going to naturally deteriorate if you don't. And that's what we need to do. This particular view, it's interesting. I call it a compromised dualistic substitute for God, because it really bleeds over into a lot of the different views we're looking at. There would be parts of what Plato teaches that Spinoza, in the view we just looked at, would agree with. As a Western pantheist, he would agree with the importance of knowledge and the intellect and feeding that, understanding. That's very important. When we get into some of these later views, you're going to see some of these same ideas as well bleeding off into those views as we get there. Anybody who thinks about the importance of knowledge, intellect, will often go back and quote Plato. And a lot of these views talk about that. Every view we've looked at so far, every view we will look at tonight, will talk about the importance of thinking, reason, logic. So he has an influence on all of them. And I'm not saying it's wrong to think and reason and have logic, okay? But he would say that's what we need to do. If we want to keep changing ourselves, education of the mind, keep working on that. Now then, we move into these last two, and they are related, just like the first two were related. The thing that relates both of these is that they are atheistic. If you ask a person in either one of these last two groups, do you believe in God, they would say no. There is no God. The first view, though, has an impersonal substitute for God. And the last one has a personal substitute for God. They would say there is no God, but then when you talk to them or read their literature further, what you find is there is something that's ultimate out there. And some of those things are impersonal, like nature, history, environment, the mind, and that sort of thing. And some of them are personal, like mankind or me as a person. I'm a person. So that's very personal. So an impersonal atheistic substitute for God, nature, history, environment, the mind, those would be some of these impersonal atheistic substitutes for God. So number one, there is no creator God to look to or to count on. Number two, mankind is part of something bigger than themselves, according to this view, and this something has certain godlike qualities that should be recognized and respected. They would never call it God. A person who would fall into this view would never call nature God, but they would refer to Mother Nature or nature as having sovereign control or getting even or making things square. You better take care of Mother Nature and that sort of thing, or else. You better get on the good side of human history, or else. You better change your environment, or it's going to change you, Skinner would say, etc. So, number three, the wise person gets in step with and contributes to the good of that which is godlike. Whether history, according to Karl Marx, or nature, according to Spinoza and many pantheists today, whether the environment, B.F. Skinner, or the mind, Plato and others. I encourage you, would you just, the most prominent of all these today would be nature, first of all. Then you would probably see either the mind or the environment being referred to most often. And probably history in the day in which we live today would be a distant fourth of these different views that we're looking at. But nature, by far and away, seems to be the prevalent one today. Try to watch a newscast, any station you want, without and watch it two or three nights in a row, and you will hear references to things about nature. And you will hear them make reference to nature as if it is a sovereign, controlling thing. You will hear people joke about Mother Nature because they don't want to get to the serious side of saying nature is godlike. That wouldn't be very professional to say that, so they'll just say Mother Nature and that sort of thing. But I challenge you to listen to the news for a few nights in a row without hearing them talk about nature in a way as if it is in a controlling sense. Better take care of nature so it will take care of you. And if you don't take care of nature, it won't take care of you, and you're going to pay the consequences for it and everything. In fact, all of these views would say that. You better take care of better get on the good side of history, or get on the good, create a good environment to live in. So if you change your environment, it'll change your outward behavior, change your mind, and it'll change things around you as well, change you. Number four, we experience change only in the sense that life works better for us the more in step we are with the godlikeness that we worship. As we enable the godlikeness to function the way it should, the more we may benefit from it in some way. We need to get free of things that limit us from functioning within or under the godlikeness. Get away from those things. And a lot of our literature would say you need to get away from religion, especially Christianity, especially Judaism. You need to get away from those things because they are going to limit your ability to get on the good side of that which is really most powerful. Now, this whole next section is taken from pantheism.net, okay? So just went to the web and did a bunch of research and thought this was a good summary of a lot of things as it relates to how do we change. Let's just look at the first paragraph there. Every one of us is a participant in divinity, not in some distant future after death, but right now, every one of us is a potential focus of consciousness of divinity. So we are called to respect other humans as sacred, fellow members of the divinity. As you read through this whole thing that they've done, what they're talking about is nature is divine. And we are all part of nature, so we are each one divine. We are each one godlike. And everything. We should also help others, we go on to say, it goes on to say in the next paragraph, we should also help others to realize their kinship with nature and their belonging to the universe, realizing the dual sense of to become aware of and to make real. To become aware of nature and to make real that which is around us. Now look down at the third paragraph that's underlined, that one sentence. Even if people are aware of the connection, there may be obstacles that prevent them from making it real, making this that we're talking about real. These include, what are things that are obstacles to prevent us from making our divinity all that it can be, if I could put it in that way, as gods that are part of this nature. It is divine. It's godlike. We are part of it, so we are divine. We are godlike as well. How can I realize the fullness of that? There are some things that get in the way. And in the next three paragraphs, they mention three things that get in the way. First of all, physical factors. These include physical factors, such as separation from nature and the night sky. Now, as you go on and read that paragraph, what he's talking about, what they're talking about, is one of the things that gets in the way are buildings, cities, which are man-made, which are not part of nature. We need to get away from these structures. We need to get out. We need to get out into nature, and we need to have a clear view of the night sky. We live in the city, not all of you do, but a lot of you do. You've been in the city at night enough to know there's a difference between looking up at the sky in the city and going out in the country a few miles and looking up at the sky. There's a vast difference, especially when you see stars and not clouds or something. But you know what I mean. The stars just are brighter, shinier, bigger, stand out more, and all of that because they don't have all the light of the city and all the distractions there. And I mention all this because they go on later on in this same article and talk a lot about that. I have a whole section on that and how we need to get away from that and be able to be a part of nature and see the stars, get rid of all this physical world we live in as much. The second thing that gets in the way of us realizing our full divinity as part of divine nature is in that next paragraph. There are also psychological factors, and he says in the next sentence, these include obsession, addiction, anxiety, and excessive grief. Some of these are under our own control, and with the help of pantheistic meditation and the pantheist approach to natural death, we can learn to free ourselves. So how do we change things like obsession, addiction, anxiety, and excessive grief? Pantheistic meditation is one way they would say you can change. Or die. You know, when you're dead, you don't really worry about those things too much anymore. That's what they're talking about there. Just die. End your life. And there's another thing that gets in the way in that last paragraph. They also include emotions caused by the structure of society, feelings of injustice, exploitation, oppression, and envy. These are material emotions designed to help us overcome unfair situations. We should work to eliminate the sources of these emotions in economic, insecurity, violence, lack of democracy and participation, and gross inequality. Think about what they're calling us to there. So, how do we change? The activism, getting rid of things and people that are causing us to be less divine than we were designed to be, through meditation, pantheistic meditation, and through suicide. That's how you can get rid of these things that are in the way, that are causing us problems. They wouldn't say any of those things are the result of our choosing evil over good. They would just say those are realities that exist and we need to get rid of them, and here are some ways to do that. Okay? There was a campaign back in the, 80s, I believe it was 1980s, that it was a war on drugs. And there was a campaign. I forget how many billions of dollars in America we spent on this campaign. And the slogan was, just say no. Just say no. A lot of it was spawned by this kind of thinking and everything. And it was a thoroughly unbelievably expensive campaign for probably 8 to 10 years of time. That was the campaign. You saw it on TV, the radio, billboards, all over the place. And you know how much effect it had in America? Zero. The drug problem rose during that period of time. It did not decline during that period of time for a lot of reasons. We'll get into that some more maybe next week. Let's look at the last one, a personal atheistic substitute for God. This would be one of two views, either Darwinism, which talks about the supremacy of humanity, all humanity, the human race, the human biologic species is ultimate. That would be what Darwinism would teach. Humanism teaches I, as one of those people, am ultimate. I am ultimate, and I am responsible to no one else. So both of those are speaking of persons as a substitute for God rather than something immaterial like nature or the environment. So they would say, number one, there is no creator God to look to or to count on. And number two, mankind is a product which has risen to the top of the evolutionary mountain by the achieved superiority of previous beings before him. Mankind must accept his ultimate role in the universe. So I can look at Darwinism tends to lead to humanism. Darwinism says we as humanity are ultimate, and therefore as part of humanity, I am ultimate, is where humanism, that's not the whole reason or place where humanism gets started, but that's part of it. I am ultimate. By the way, you cannot have humanism without having relativism. What do I mean by that? Humanism says, I am ultimate. Well, that means you're ultimate as well. And you are ultimate, and you are ultimate. Each one of us in this room are ultimate. So what do you do with a room full of ultimates? Who's right? Has to be relative. Has to be relative to you. You're right for you. What you think, what you believe, what you do, that's right for you. But what I think and what I believe and what I do, that's right for me. Humanism breeds relativism. You cannot have humanism without logically going to the next step of relativism. Everything's relative. Why? Because all of us are gods. We all are ultimate, and therefore it all becomes relative to me, what I think, what I feel, what I want. And that may be different than you, but you're your own god. You take care of your own stuff and everything. Therefore, number three, either we change as a result of social laws designed to keep us within certain healthy boundaries, or we really cannot change. Darwinism would talk about social laws more than humanism would. Humanism would give a nod to social laws because it has to, for practical reasons. There is a problem when all of us are our own gods. All of us are ultimately responsible to no one except to me and whatever I want. I mean, you think about, what does that look like in society? What does that look like in the world when you've got nearly 7 billion gods running around who are each one ultimate? What happens in the world? Politically, socially, what we call that is anarchy. Everybody doing what's right in their own eyes, which we see in Judges 17 to 21. Again, I've mentioned that before, but that would be an interesting passage to read and see what happens in a society when everyone does what's right in their own eyes, which is what is being promoted in the world in which we live today a great deal. Darwinism would talk about the importance of social laws for mankind. Humanism would give a, if we have to, we'll talk about social laws for survival's sake, because we can't all be ultimate and be right about everything. So either we change as a result of social laws designed to keep us within certain healthy boundaries, or we really cannot change. And most of these would say we really cannot change inwardly. Look at the next couple of statements. And this is where Skinner comes back into view. Skinner was to this question, okay, follow me here. Skinner was to this question for the atheistic world what Darwin was to that same world for the first question, where do we come from? He gave them some kind of a semblance of authority or some kind of an answer that made a little bit of sense and everything. Not an ultimate answer, but it gave it some scientific credibility anyway. Skinner does the same thing for this question. How do we change? Notice parts 4 and 5 and see Skinner written all over it. Many would say that we can't change, and I would just say on the inside, our essence, who we really are, okay? We are products of our environment historically in our present living of life. We can't change who we really are on the inside. But number 5, our behavior can and should be modified, either naturally or manufactured. How do we change? Well, we can't change who we are. We are who we are. But we can change our behavior through behavior modification, through putting us in little cages and putting electricity on one and food on the other. I mean, that we, you can manufacture it, so we can modify behavior. And we have tried that. By the way, some of you are familiar with some of the things that the Army got involved in World War II, trying to get soldiers to do certain things when they really didn't want to. A lot of the brainwashing, a lot of that kind of stuff that started going on. Skinner, remember it was 1947, he went to work for Harvard, World War II, 42 to 46 in that range. He got involved in those formative years of World War II in introducing a lot of behavior modification in the military. Brainwashing, a lot of stuff. He got involved in that kind of stuff. So can't change the inside, but you can change the outside. Behavior modification. It's interesting to watch certain shows on TV right now, some series that are on, and you see a lot of this being introduced in those shows of behavior modification, how to change people, how to get them to do what you want them to do. A lot of shows are talking about that, and we would say, well, those are extraneous. Those are way out there. Okay, if you say so. But not all of it. How many of you ever watched the Bourne series? Yeah, some of you seen that. I mean, what's that all about? It's training these guys to behave a certain way and to do certain things upon command. And anyway, there's a lot of interest in that in our world today. Our behavior can and should be modified, either naturally or manufactured. So look at the bottom. You enjoyed B.F. Skinner so much this week. Let's read a little bit more here. Contingencies are accessible, and as we come to understand the relations between behavior and the environment, we discover new ways of changing behavior. The outlines of a technology are already clear. An assignment is stated as behavior to be produced or modified, and relevant contingencies are then arranged. What can we do to change that behavior, in other words? A program sequence of contingencies may be needed. Can you see the little boy trying to tweak things and make things different, change things, make them better in all of this? The technology has been most successful where behavior can be fairly easily specified and where appropriate contingencies can be constructed. For example, in childcare, these are the places he's talking about where it's easy and accessible and where we see it today. In childcare, schools, the management of retards, institutionalized psychotics. The same principles are being applied, however, in the preparation of instructional materials. Behavior modification, how you prepare lessons, how you prepare tests, all that kind of stuff goes on at the educational level, in psychotherapy, beyond simple management, in rehabilitation, in industrial management, in urban design, how we design our urban communities, and many other fields of human behavior. There are many varieties of behavior modification and many different formulations, but they all agree on the essential point. Behavior can be changed by changing the conditions of which it is a function. Change the environment, change the circumstances, change things around it, and you can change the behavior. So they would say, can we change? Yes. How do you do that? The primary answer we would say today is you need to either medicate or you need to put them through a series of training programs that gets them to experience things in a different way, a different environment, a different way of doing things than they've done them before, and do that repetitively until it becomes habitual for them and then you've changed their behavior. But all they're talking about is changing outward actions, not changing the heart of who we are. In any way. You see, there's not a problem in this view with the heart. The problem is we've grown accustomed to the environment we're in and we've adjusted to it. And so now then we need to switch that and do different things than we did before. But they wouldn't say there's anything wrong with the heart. They wouldn't say there's anything such as evil or anything like that that needs to be changed at all. None of that. We just need to change the environment. They would, in fact, there are some people who would talk about changing behavior even who would challenge that and say, if you go back to that second worldview that we looked at, it's not our behavior that's wrong, it's just the way we think. And Spinoza starts bleeding into that as well, and so a lot of people say, well, we don't need to change at all. Who would agree with this last view? There's nothing about us that needs to change. But there is a real emphasis, generally speaking, on behavior modification, changing the way we do things. And quite frankly, churches have become masters at helping people change their behavior and calling it life change. Changing what we do, and I'm not speaking down about all churches and all pastors and all that, but think about if most of the books, if you went into a Christian bookstore, the bulk of the books are going to talk about how you need to be different, do different things than you do now. The way you take care of your finances, you need to modify that behavior. It's basically what they're saying. Your morality, you need to modify your morality. Your relationships, you need to modify your relationships, change it. I can't find a guy, I can't find a girl. You need to modify your behavior, and you'll be able to find that guy, be able to find that girl. Change your environment, and you'll be able to do that. And you'll see that over and over again. You'll see it in terms of sermons, the emphasis upon these are things we need to change. And often what we're talking about is go be a different person on the outside. So I'm not just pointing at these worldviews and saying, boy, they are terrible. We've got it all put together. I think we have been sucked into the world of behavior modification in great measure with the rest of the world within the church. And we need to be careful of that and what that can lead to. Because what it will lead to is a lot of people who are disillusioned and burned out in the church. Because God didn't intend us just to change our behavior. He promised to change who we are on the inside, which would then have an impact on the outside and would change our behavior. And that's what we're going to look at starting next week. We'll look at that, what the Bible has to say about can we change, and if so, how? How can we do that? Let me pray. Father, thank you so much for who you are. Thank you for all that you've done for us. Thank you that there is so much more for us than just what these alternate worldviews have to offer. God, I pray that you would help us to see through the things that are real by your design and the things that seem real because we've heard them over and over again. Help us to truly be discerning individuals. Help our minds to be sharp and thoughtful and to take everything back to the scriptures and test it there. Help us not to take things in this world or even in the church at face value, but help us to become students who study your word more deeply and understand what you have said and how you have designed life, how you've designed us, how we can change by your design. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. There's a last page there. You can look over that, but I said most of what's there. So next week we will move into what the Bible has to say. You have some discussion questions. And by the way, I sit down in front because if anybody wants to come and talk with me about anything, I'm here. Come and talk with me. I'm glad to do that.